From Los Angeles, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick. Here's a news headline. The Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case about state scholarships for kids who want to study religion. There's a dispute over that. NPR's Nina Totenberg will have the story and full details later today on All Things Considered.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
Former President Richard Nixon, 30 years ago in November, denying involvement in the Watergate cover-up. Less than a year later, after evidence emerged that he was lying, Mr. Nixon resigned office in disgrace. And even after his death 9 years ago, he remains a figure of controversy and fascination who, in many ways, still shapes public life today. Historian David Greenberg is the author of a new book, Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image. Richard Nixon, he says, seemed to intuitively understand the merger of politics and media.
Nixon was one of the first politicians of the post-World War II era to bring in these concerns with image making, to bring in experts from television, public relations, advertising, this whole world, to make that part of the political process. And so I think Nixon was really a pioneer in image making in a way that few politicians of our times were.
And he kept changing his image. There was a new Nixon. It began with that image in his first congressional race. He started that out as a kind of a, I'm a conservative Republican. I believe in less government. I believe in more individual effort. And then he turned to anti-communism in his first race against a congressman, an incumbent congressman, Democrat named Jerry Voorhees.
That's right. For Nixon, those two pieces of his ideology, the anti-communism and the free market economics, were tied to what I call a conservative populism. And this was really the first Nixon image. That is to say, it wasn't just a traditional Republican conservative. It wasn't just a McCarthyite red baiter. What Nixon did was to take these ideological components and weave them into his very persona.
He does achieve a lot of popularity early on in his career. The Saturday Evening Post is writing articles about this young and vibrant and handsome congressman from California. Then he's on the ticket, the national ticket. Dwight Eisenhower asked him to run for vice president along with General Eisenhower's presidential candidacy. And then there's trouble because it turns out that some of Nixon's supporters in California have this private fund, $18,000. He's in trouble. He might get dropped from the ticket. And he goes on television and he makes this speech that's come to be known as the Checkers speech. Here's a part of that.
One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
When we listen to that speech now, David Greenberg, I think of it as something that people have mocked and made fun of. But you write that this was actually tremendously powerful in 1952.
Yeah, that's right. What's interesting about the reaction to the speech at the time is not just that it was overwhelmingly successful, that people wrote in telling Eisenhower to keep Nixon on the ticket. There was really a feeling that Nixon had cemented his own identification with these middle-class voters whose support he needed. Nixon was really quite successful in using television. And remember, this was the speech that had the largest audience ever. And so Nixon reaches out to this huge mass of Americans who respond with great enthusiasm, who see him as an authentic embodiment of these kind of middle-class values that the Republicans are trying to promote to advance their prospects in the early post-war era.
One of the things about Nixon that's so interesting is the passions that he aroused in his supporters, but also in his opponents. I mean, the left just hated this guy.
That's right. In Nixon's Shadow, I devote a whole chapter to the left and Nixon. If for the early 1950s liberals, who I also write about, they worry about Nixon with the anti-communism, with the sense that he's manipulating television to project this positive middle-class image. With the new left, I think it's really rooted in Vietnam and with the repression that they feel is going on at home. And so Nixon really becomes an embodiment of all that's wrong with America in these years. Their savage cartoons, their satire, they depict him in all kinds of conspiracies, including involving him in the Kennedy assassination. He really reaches a kind of level of demonization that it's hard to find elsewhere in American politics.
It's hard to find, but in part it's supported by the way history developed, the Watergate scandal, his eventual disgrace, and his resignation from office. Here's a bit of what Richard Nixon had to say on that occasion.
Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself. And so we leave with high hopes, in good spirit, and with deep humility.
President Richard Nixon on the occasion of his resignation from the presidency, August 8, 1974, speaking to his White House staff. He leaves Washington. He goes to California. I think the left that we talked about earlier was thinking, that's great, we've seen the last of that guy. But that's not what happens. Nixon comes back still again, another new Nixon.
Well, that's right. You have to admire Nixon's tenacity in a way, his refusal just to go off and die and become irrelevant to the political discourse. He knows that if he stands a chance of rehabilitating himself, it's going to be by making the public, making historians and pundits and others aware of his accomplishments with the Soviet Union, with opening relations to China, and hoping that those diplomatic achievements will somehow come to dwarf the shame of Watergate. I don't think he ever really succeeds in that, but he knows that if he has a ticket to rehabilitation, that's going to be it.
David Greenberg, when you look at the presidency today, presidency of George Bush, do you see the lessons of Richard Nixon in his understanding of politics?
Well, there are certainly connections that can be drawn, even direct lineages, I think, that can be drawn from Bush back to Nixon. But more generally, I think you do see this focus on image making in the Bush White House, and I would also say in other presidencies between Nixon and Bush. And it's, I think, best exemplified maybe in that flight deck landing of last May, when Bush, in this what seemed at the time to be this great moment of triumph, surrounds himself with Navy sailors dressed in his flight suit, and thinks he can control his image by projecting this aura of great victory in Iraq. 6 months later, Time magazine runs a cover with that same photo saying, "Mission not accomplished." And that itself harkens back to Nixon, the way that he tried to control his image, but his image ultimately proved elusive, and it was elements of the public who determined it, not Nixon himself.
David Greenberg, author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image, thanks for joining us on Day to Day.
Thanks, Alex.